all the hypersonic missiles fired by Iran have hit their targets after evading Israel's air defense systems. Iran warns that Tehran will give a harsh response to enemies who might try to cross the country's red lines and harm its national interests. And another Palestinian youth has been killed as Israeli forces launch a fresh deadly incursion into the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. Well, welcome to the studios near the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran has retaliated against Israel over the regime's deadly attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria early this month. Iran says the attack targeted an Israeli airbase and an intelligence headquarters near Syria that were behind the deadly attack on the Iranian embassy. Hundreds of drones, ballistic and cruise missiles were used in the attack. It was conducted in several stages from multiple directions in order to suppress and overwhelm Israel's missile shields. Tehran says the attack has achieved all of its objectives. This was the first time that Iran directly attacked the Israeli-occupied territories. It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. All hypersonic missiles fired by Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps have hit their designated targets in Israel, marking the first time that Iran employs such weapons against real targets. The Israeli regime and its supporters failed to intercept any of the hypersonic missiles fired by Iran. These missiles were fired alongside drones, other ballistic and cruise missiles during the retaliatory operation against Israel. Iran is one of the few countries that possesses the technology to produce hypersonic missiles. These missiles can travel at stunning speeds and hit their targets with great precision. Iran's hypersonic missiles are highly maneuverable, enabling them to have an unpredictable flight path in order to confuse enemies' missile shields. The IRGC says tracking Iran's hypersonic missiles is impossible. Saad Nimr is a professor of political science at Birzeit University who joins us from occupied Ramallah. We have Hakimet Sagayabiria, who's an academic and political analyst, joining us from Tehran. Welcome to you both. Saad Nimr, let me first start with you. We're looking at the technical aspect of Iran's military capacity, where the hypersonic missiles is one of them. But let's look at the bigger picture as to the impact that this has had, the first time from Iranian territory that the Israel regime was targeted, and maybe the first time that the Israel regime has felt an onslaught of this scale. In terms of the impact that's going to have on the plight of Palestinians in particular, do you think that this may force the regime to recalculate the way that it approaches the issue of Palestine, given the genocidal aggression that it's exercising right now?
If we are talking on the strategical point or issue, it will be a little bit long time. But definitely, it's helping a lot in the overall problem in Palestine. It's now it's sitting. Iran is sitting now a new formula for the engagement with the Zionist movement and the Zionist regime. For the Palestinians, definitely that was very good, and they were very happy with what happened the day before yesterday. But at the same time, as we say, the impact or the effect of this strike, it will come gradually and later on rather than sooner. Sooner, it was a hit for a target which was picked carefully by the Iranian leadership, and it was hit and the decoy of lots of drones and other missiles. It was just, you know, to confuse the enemy while the other missiles are hitting the base. Now, that was a great successful from our point of view. Now, how that will affect the Palestinians in the long run? First of all, we know that the Israelis knew now or know that they are not going to target Iran in any moment, and that might escalate the whole situation into a regional war that they could not tolerate or even can deal with it. The Americans, on the other hand, who are now convincing and pressurizing Israel not to retaliate, it means that the Americans who helped them in bringing down some of the rockets the day before yesterday with the French and the Israeli as well, and also Jordan, we know, and other countries which participated in anticipation of the missiles. Now the Americans have a more, if you like, influence over Israel, and I think that they are going to pressurize them to finish the deal, to hand over the Palestinian prisoners for the Israeli prisoners who are captive by the Palestinian resistance. So we believe, yes, that the American now could say, yeah, see, we've been helping you, we've been protecting you, but now you have also to comply with what we want. So maybe that will be a kind of pressurizing the Israeli more to accept the deal, and in such case it will be declaration of the victory for the Palestinians and a defeat for the Israelis, since they did not achieve any of their targets in this war.
Well, Mr. Kimeh, if we want to take a look at the whole scenario here, this is something that is considered to be a very measured response from the Iranian side, and many don't look at it or understand that that is was the case, because on one hand you have Iran that actually forewarned from days ago that it was going to conduct a retaliatory attack, and it went ahead and did that anyways, and it did that with a combination of different types of items that it has in its military weaponry arsenal, which included these hypersonic missiles, which hit their targets. And that's another aspect of this, that it sent the message where it can hit targets with pinpoint accuracy. Mm-hmm. How does that change the equation militarily in the region against the Israeli regime and for Iran, and the message it sends to the regional countries at the same time?
Yes, it is one thing for military analysts and generals to talk about the idea that Iran has reached overmatch, something that was talked about in a New Yorker article by General McKenzie, CENTCOM leader, previous CENTCOM leader, United States official, that he said that Iran has reached the capability, a sort of capability that it is very difficult for the United States or any other power to basically control it militarily, let alone to defeat it militarily. But that it is one thing to talk about it, and it is another thing to see it happen and actually be realized. So this is what we are witnessing, that we are seeing the very complex military power that Iran has been able to build over the years, and beside that, we are witnessing the military, the strategic military thinking of the IRGC that was able to carry out this complex operation and get through with it successfully. So it is very important. A very important thing that we are witnessing right now. It is going to change the calculations of the players on the ground, of course, including the United States and Israeli regime. I hope that this is going to be something that is going to work towards bringing about more stability to the region. Before. What happened two nights ago, the Israeli regime looked at the Palestinian people and, of course, any other target that it had in its mind as defenseless populations. In the case of the Palestinian people, the Israeli regime looks at it as a defenseless indigenous population that has to be either controlled or eliminated in order for the Israeli settler colonialist machine to work and move forward. But now I think they have to look at things differently, and they have to see the reality on the ground, which is that not only aren't these people defenseless in terms of world public opinion, you know, that because of the, you know, the very awakening that we are seeing in terms of the public opinion being on the side of the Palestinian people, being against the genocidal actions of the Israeli regime, but also we are witnessing that there is, you know, a real power on the ground that is going to take action whenever it is necessary.
All right, thank you very much. Let me thank our guest there from Ramallah, Saad Nimr, Professor of Political Science at Brzezet University, and Hakimia Saleh Iberia, Academic and Political Analyst. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review. The U.S. Security Council has held an emergency meeting at the request of the Tel Aviv regime following Iran's drone and missile attacks on Israeli targets in the occupied territories. In an opening speech, the U.N. chief reiterated his condemnation of the Israeli attack on the premises of the Iranian embassy in Damascus.
The principle of inviolability of diplomatic and consular premises and personnel must be respected in all cases, in accordance with international law, as I stated when condemning the 1 April attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Madam President, it's time to step back from the brink. It's vital to avoid any action that could lead to major military confrontations on multiple fronts in the Middle East. Civilians are already bearing the brunt and paying the highest price.
Guterres further called for de-escalation in the region. He then reminded UN member states of their collective responsibility to work toward the establishment of an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The UN chief also highlighted the importance of delivering humanitarian aid to residents of Gaza and securing the release of all captives. He added that all UN members are duty-bound to stop Israel's acts of violence in the occupied West Bank and re-establish safe navigation in the Red Sea. He urged efforts to further promote regional and international peace and security. Also speaking at the Security Council's emergency meeting, the Russian envoy to the UN once again condemned the Israeli strike on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus, urging UN member states to denounce such an act. The Russian envoy further lashed out at the US, Britain, and France for refusing to abide by principles of international law, namely on the immunity of diplomatic facilities. Separately, the Chinese ambassador to the UN also condemned the Israeli regime's attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria. He dismissed the incident as a gross violation of the UN Charter and international law. By launching such an attack, he added that Tel Aviv violated the sovereignty of both Syria and Iran. Meanwhile, Iran's ambassador and permanent representative to the UN said that Iran's drone and missile strike on Israeli targets in the occupied territories was in retaliation for the Israeli strike on the Iranian embassy. Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, in a phone call with his Russian counterpart, says the operation True Promise meant to warn Israel that any future aggression will be answered. Amir Abdollahian confirmed that the operation True Promise was executed to punish the Zionist regime for its recent crimes. Amir Abdollahian further signified the importance of Russia's role in de-escalating tensions in the region. Russia's foreign minister, for his part, criticized some members of the U.S. Security Council for not condemning Israel's strike on Iran's embassy in Syria. Sergei Lavrov also mentioned that Russia strongly supports Iran in exercising its inherent right to defend itself. Tehran says stage by stage, Iran will give stronger responses in order to deter and to punish any aggressor who might cross its red lines.
No, Iran does not seek escalation of tension in the region. Iran stresses again that it is committed to the goals and aspirations as per the United Nations Charter and international law regarding passing the red lines of Iran. In any stage, Iran will stand stronger than the previous stage in order to create deterrence and to punish the aggressor, the violator, or any illogical and illegal move. Iran will take action. So I should highlight again that Iran's action was necessary and proportionate, and it hit military targets.
Qanani said Iran's action was completely legitimate and in accordance with the UN Charter. He said the operation was carried out after diplomatic ultimatums were ignored by Israel's allies. He added that Western countries should appreciate Iran for its responsible behavior and restraint towards Israel. The spokesman also said inaction of the U.S. Security Council and the irresponsible behavior by the U.S., U.K., and France forced Iran to take action in order to defend its security and national interests. At least one Palestinian has been killed as the Israeli occupying forces launch another deadly incursion into the northern West Bank city of Nablus. The regime's raids in the West Bank have intensified since its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip began. The U.S.-Israeli genocidal war in Gaza enters day 192 as the regime steps up its aerial and artillery strikes against the central part of the besieged strip. The Gaza Health Ministry said 43 Palestinians have been killed and 62 others wounded in the past 24 hours. Five people have been killed in Israeli strikes targeting Nusayrat refugee camp in the central part of the war-torn strip. Warplanes also launched attacks against the house in the Al-Maghazi refugee camp in Deir al-Balah. Gaza's health officials say the number of civilians killed in Israel's six-month war on the blockaded territory has exceeded 33,700, mostly women and children. Nearly 76,400 others have been injured. The regime has also increased its violence against Palestinians in the West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 464 Palestinians have been killed and 4,800 others injured in the occupied territory since October 7, 2023. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Economic divide.
There is no doubt that the Israeli economy is taking a beating due to the genocidal war that is waging against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. Now, the hit that the economy is taking is on the boycott front, but how much of a hit? Is it enough to make a difference? And how about on other fronts like education boycott or cultural boycott and on diplomatic fronts? Those are some of the issues we'll be covering in this edition of Economic Divide. Some of the headlines coming up, the call for a boycott, it has had an effect on major brands. Southeast Asia in particular, and Muslim countries. We will be taking a look at that. And also, obviously, companies that are profiting from the genocide that's taking place in the Gaza Strip. Another one of our highlights is going to be on U.S. companies, Israeli investments, in particular, Intel. It goes by INTC, the chip-making giant. A $25 billion investment on occupied land, but freezing U.S. expansion. That means that it's investing in the genocide that's taking place. And then finally, we're going to take a look at the boycott success rate. Two organizations stand out in particular, Starbucks and McDonald's, on how it has been impacted. Also, grassroots organic boycott is another area we're going to be taking a look at, along with diplomatic educational boycott.
Calls for boycotting products perceived to have links to Israel are gaining momentum across Southeast Asia, and their impact on major brands' bottom lines is becoming increasingly noticeable, like on Puma, Chevron, HP, Volvo, and Siemens. In the case of McDonald's, the company said in February that the aggression was part of the reason international sales rose by just 0.7%,
during the fourth quarter of 2023, down sharply from a 16.5% expansion during the same period the previous year. In an earnings call, McDonald's CEO Chris Kempczinski said, "The most pronounced impact that we're seeing is in the Middle East and in Muslim countries, like Indonesia and Malaysia. Other brands that have been affected by boycotts include Unilever and coffee chain Starbucks. Unilever, which produces Dove soap, Ben & Jerry's ice cream, and Knorr stock cubes, said in February that sales in Indonesia had experienced a double-digit decline during the fourth quarter last year as a result of geopolitically focused consumer-facing campaigns. In the case of Starbucks, the company's franchisee in Malaysia, Berjaya Food, reported a 38.2% drop in revenue in the fourth quarter of last year, which it attributed to an ongoing boycott. Time now to take a look at some social media posts. And believe me, on this topic, there were so many we looked at. So here goes with the ones that we picked. Google reinstating No Thanks app for identifying boycotting Israeli-linked companies. That's pretty interesting. Let's find out how this works, actually. Here's an explanation of that, showing how widespread this type of software is used.
Starting today, the boycott against Israel is changed forever. There's a new app called No Thanks. It's on iOS and Android, and it lets anybody, anywhere, scan the barcode of any product to see whether or not that product is on the boycott for Israel list. For example, it'll tell you whether or not that fruit you're trying to buy was grown in a legal settlement, or if the company that made the product you're buying is profiting off of the oppression of the Palestinians.
Okay, now, Movement Win, 100-plus cultural organizations have endorsed the 2004 call of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, PACBI, over the past 6 months. It said, join us. Next, Israel wants no witnesses. Are we going to let them? Never. We will continue to share, march, and boycott like we have never before. I am boycotting like my life depends on it, and we are millions doing it. We will starve them economically. Sanction Israel now. And then, the UN Special Rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, beacon of truth, she speaks here of the genocide under the scars of Palestinian children, who will suffer for generations to come. She calls for arms embargo, boycott economic and diplomatic sanctions against Israel. All right, so there you have it, the special rapporteur there coming out and calling for a boycott. We'll see how effective that is. Let me introduce our guest for this section of the program. Dr. Mojgan Sabahia Asfahani joins us. She's an Iranian native and environmentalist who is the people's candidate for Ann Arbor City Council in 2024, starting now, as it states on her X account. Well, Mojgan, welcome to the program. Taking a look at first Southeast Asia, there are calls to boycott products there, obviously with links to Israel, or having a noticeable impact on the bottom line of the major brands, which in some ways shows the effectiveness of boycotting. How effective do you think the boycotting campaign is when it comes to the impact that it's making on the company's bottom line? Are they really suffering?
Thank you, Kobe, for giving me a chance to speak with you. It's good to be back. I think the issue of boycott, divestment, and sanction has been discussed repeatedly for at least the past 10 years. And right now, the movement, which was originated by people of Palestine, they called for divestment sanctions against Israel, I want to say 20 years ago, was picked up by student organizations across the globe and in the United States where I am. And there is a huge support and push for that right now in the United States. And there is indications that companies are suffering and their monetary situation is getting jeopardized because of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. Specifically, I know that McDonald's and the coffee, Starbucks coffee, have suffered greatly. In fact, there is a Starbucks coffee downtown of Ann Arbor, which has gone out of business. So these things are all true. And similarly, I am sure in Southeast Asia and other places, companies that have ties to apartheid Israel are suffering. But what I want to focus on is that just as we saw with apartheid South Africa, the main force that took South Africa, racist South Africa, out of the global scene was not exactly sanctions. It was the ruination of South Africa in terms of their legitimacy. They had lost their legitimacy. They were isolated in the eyes of millions and millions of people in the world. They were cut off from diplomatic relationships with many, many countries. And that was the main driver that pushed South Africa out of the global setting.
All right, thank you for that, Moshe Khan. We appreciate that. Let's see what our next guests think. Amen, that is Jamil, West Asia correspondent at Global Defense Insight, with her interest lying in West Asia, Pakistan, and foreign policy analysis of that. Amen, Jamil, welcome to the program. This particular case involving Intel, it's a U.S. chip-making giant that I'm sure you're familiar with, to invest $25 billion in Israel or occupy Palestine. At the same time, freezing plans to actually expand its chip making manufacturing in the States. Basically, it's stating that it wants to invest in a war zone, this genocidal war that's taking place. That's where it puts its interest. I mean, doesn't that make it complicit in this genocide that's taking place in the Gaza Strip?
Well, making such allegations that they are complicitly involved in the genocide, is not like we cannot make that such a big statement, because however the amount the America is going to invest in tech making chips in Israel, definitely it is a significant development, but it might have their strategic ambitions to fulfill in the Middle Eastern region, like as America is losing its position in Middle East, so to grab that position back in the region, America wants to make its foot more stronger in the region. So I believe that having a hold on its domestic domestic production of the chips, America has like moved towards Israel for achieving their geostrategic ambitions in the region.
It's time now for the InfoNews section of the program. First up, we're going to take a look at China's economy. It's called China's Economic Strength based on the title that Bloomberg gave it. It said China's incredible growth threatens American and EU economies. That came from the U.S. trade chief. She said Beijing's non-market policies should be rebuffed through appropriate countermeasures. She also called for, quote, defensive policies such as tariffs, as well as measures that are more on the offense, including incentive measures. Can you believe it? You have an economy that's doing well, that is a challenge, or competition, as the U.S. would like to call it, but based on the measures they are taking and would like to take, they want to make sure that that economy does not grow. Go figure. It's the U.S. for you. Next up, Ukraine is under bankruptcy at this point based on this particular entry. It came from the World Bank, which issued this warning that the public finances in that country are catastrophic. It added that Ukraine could go bankrupt as early as next year unless Western countries agree to write off or restructure its debts. Next up, back to China. China's influence in this case. More than half of the people in Southeast Asia would side with China over the U.S. if forced to choose. Now, last year, only 38.9% of respondents preferred China. Also, China was chosen as the most influential economic power in the region by most respondents. This particular piece of news was picked to show the U.S. how it stands when it comes to its relationship with countries in that part of the world and how they view China. Taking a look at our final piece here, it's the economic losses on the Gaza Strip. The U.N. has come out and said that the World Bank division, that estimates are that the infrastructure damage is at $18.5 billion this to have occurred in the first 4 months of Israel's devastating genocidal war. Now, that's equivalent to 97% of the combined GDP of the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip for the year 2022. Damages to infrastructure facilities impacted all sectors of the economy, with residential buildings, unbelievable, accounting for 72% of the cost. That's 72%. Those are the ones we picked for our info news section.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The in-depth section of the program is upon us. When it comes to boycotting Israel, there has been an uptick of anti-Israeli movements in all spheres, from economic ones to cultural ones to even sports. But as with all boycotts, the question is, how efficient has it been? Let's try to find out how efficient it has been or not. So, a good place to start is by looking at the global demonstrations in response to the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war across the world, as outlined in this map. Now, when it comes to this, some examples are seen on this map, with a focus on the United States that you see over here, also Germany, West Asia, and Africa. In terms of the U.S., it had 600 demonstrations, as you see here, Germany with 170, and you have West Asia and North Africa with 1,400. The top five countries were the United States, Yemen, Turkey, Iran, and Morocco. And the key numbers, they're the ones that you see up here. When it comes to, for example, pro-Palestine demonstrations, there were over 3,700. That's 90% that it raked in. Pro-Israel demonstrations, we also took a note of that, over 520, which came in at 13%. And also you have the neutral ones, which came in at, from what we understand, 100. Now, in terms of the total, that came in at 4,200 altogether, the number of demos. Now, next up, we took a look at four different areas that the boycott campaign has actually had its impact. Losses per year, thousands of job losses, $10.5 billion. Israel actually has a budget to fight BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, $33 million. $28.6 million yearly, lost to Central Farms, for example, in the Jordan Valley. And then you have student councils, associations of supporting BDS, over 50. And then finally, you have hundreds of artists who have backed a cultural boycott of Israel. Okay? So you can see that actually different sectors, the boycott campaign is having an effect on, especially when it comes to things like culture. Now, let's move on to the next section of this, where we took a look at one example of the impact. The Alshaya Group, that owns Starbucks in the West Asia and Africa region, actually had to lay off a lot of workers based on the franchises that it had. The number came in at 2,000 plus, and these jobs were lost because of the boycott that happened when it came to Starbucks. Okay, so obviously it shows that there's an impact. Moving on to the next item that we thought would be important for you, this would be another franchise chain, if we can move on to the next item here. And the next item would be McDonald's. It actually had to sign a deal to purchase all 225 of the restaurants that comprise this Israel franchise. This followed months of dramatically lower sales due to pro-Palestine boycott action. Now, the next item that we took a look at is also important. This would be the military. Let's take a look at the military boycott. What do we have here? First of all, weapons manufacturers that sell to Israel are supported by investments worth hundreds of millions of U.S. dollars from Canadian pension funds. That's the premise of this. And different military manufacturers in terms of the contributions that they have made. Now, again, this is for Canadian pension funds. From Honeywell to Lockheed Martin to Boeing, and the respective amounts, $217 million, $137 million, etc. Now, let's go to the pension fund itself. if we can go to the next item, how that's broken down. The Canadian public pension funds, well, they have had, it's about $1.6 billion. The exact amount is actually $1.634 billion. The breakdown is in terms of the respective amounts and money that's basically supporting Israeli apartheid, including arms dealers. So how military manufacturers are making out when it comes to the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. Let's bring in our guests and get more information on this boycott campaign. All right, let's bring back our guests and see what they think. We have Dr. Mojgan Savabiasvarani rejoining us, an Iranian native and environmentalist. Mojgan, welcome back to the program. Boycotting Israeli-linked products, it's been promoted for a long time. We know that. What we'd like to find out, whether this time around is different due to the depth of the genocide that's taking place, the continuous protests, for example, and the length and of the aggression and the onslaught.
I have no doubt that that is the case, which means right now there's a lot more countries that are involved and are actively seeking to boycott Israel. That is absolutely true. I mean, I've been in the movement of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, I would say, pretty much since I was like 20 years old. That's a long time. And I had seen rises and ebbs in this whole issue of boycott, divestment, and sanctions. I have never seen such rigorous and fierce determination on the part of the young, middle-aged, everyone, to cut off Israel. But again, as I said before, the main force that will take Israel out is political isolation, is delegitimization of the state of Israel, and the amount of disrespect that they have gained by murder, by killing, by burning, by destroying hospitals, and virtually murdering at will and consciously and clearly with the aim to kill people, going in and killing people. All of this has made Israel extremely clearly in the minds of the world, they've made them extremely unpopular. And their vicious, vulgar attacks on children and women and hospitals and schools and you name it, it has left no ambiguity in the fact that Israel is a criminal, genocidal state, and it is bad for the world.
All right, thank you for that. Let's bring back Ayman Jamil now. She is a West Asia correspondent at Global Defense Insight. Ayman Jamil, welcome back to the program. We're trying to figure out here whether this boycott campaign is actually having an impact. We know it is, but this time around, I think it's different if you agree or not. Tell us what you think because of the length of how this genocidal war is now 6 months old and it doesn't seem like it's going to end. Do you think that this time around is different?
Well, these various movements will definitely have the impact, and I believe that they are very much timely because the intensity of the conflict at this time is like very high because the conflict is having the deep roots. It's not just of from October 7, it is having the deep roots since the establishment of the state of Israel since 1949, and the Palestinian peoples are facing the aggressions from then. But the impact of such movements is like pretty much timely because such movements can help in changing the policies of the Israelis towards the Israelis towards the Palestinians, because if the intensity of the protests will continue, and they will definitely lay the foundation for the continuous international opposition towards the Israeli policies towards Palestinians, so it will definitely have, the BDS policies will definitely have an impact and will put a pressure on the Israeli regime to just change their policies towards Israel, to Palestine.
The recent decision by the U.S. chip-making giant Intel, INTC, to invest $25 billion in Israel while freezing expansion plans in Ohio has drawn considerable attention, raising serious questions regarding the company's stance. Critics argue that by investing substantial funds in Israel, an entity accused of engaging in the genocide of Palestinians, Intel is complicit in the actions of the Israeli regime. controversy surrounding Intel's investment decision adds to the broader discourse on the ethical implications of business activities in genocidal war zones like Gaza. It underscores the complexity of investment choices made by multinational companies and the need for critical examination of their actions in sensitive geopolitical contexts. Time now for the quick take section. Mahdi Abbasian is on assignments. Many don't know that boycotting Israel or Israeli-linked products is an act that began a long time ago, as far back as 1945, even before the official formation of Israel. But after the genocidal war that began on October 7th of 2023, well, this movement has gained momentum. The year 1945 is significant. The Arab League organized a boycott before the establishment of Israel in 1948 on Palestinian land, with the aim to isolate Israel economically and to prevent Arab states and to discourage non-Arabs from providing economic and military support for Israel. Well, fast forward to 2024, and there are definite signs of the success of boycotting Israel, like the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movements. Over the last 18 years, the BDS movement has built a massive network worldwide. It's supported by things like trade unions and farmers, their coalitions, as well as racial, social, gender, and climate justice movements, representing tens of millions of people. BDS targets are broken down into four sections, so you know it's not just one, basically the economy. For example, these are comprised of consumer boycott targets, divestment and exclusion targets, pressure targets, and organic boycott targets. When it comes to the consumer ones, it includes brands that have a proven record of complicity in abuses against Palestinians. In terms of divestments, it includes governments which will stop doing business with companies that enable the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. In terms of pressure, that means pressure on brands and services to end their complicity in abuses against Palestinians. And organic refers to grassroots boycotts of brands that openly support Israeli violence against Palestinians. Now, one of the most recent moves receiving praise was that Google reinstated its No Thanks app for identifying boycotting Israeli-linked companies. No Thanks offers customers the ability to scan product barcodes and receive notifications if the items are produced by Israeli-linked companies. The app's initial removal on November 30th of last year, 2023, was attributed to its description, which mentioned, quote, "Welcome to No Thanks. Here you can see if the product in your hand supports killing children in Palestine or not." Finally, the boycott movement is also met by stiff resistance, especially when it comes to the U.S., the staunch support of Israel. It has actually enacted a law making it illegal for the boycott movement. Many states in the U.S. are using anti-boycott laws and executive orders to punish companies that refuse to do business with illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank. 27 states have adopted laws or policies that penalize businesses, organizations, or individuals that engage in or call for boycotts against Israel. That does it for this quick take section. Comments or questions, contact information is coming up. The boycott campaign against Israel sounds like it would be the best way for Israel to stop its apartheid policies against Palestinians. But as one of our guests stated, with each Palestinian that Israel murders in the Gaza Strip, it becomes even more isolated, delegitimizing itself. But to what point? To the point of no return? That's the key question. And that's something Israel is grappling with right now. That does it for this edition of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate you putting your time into watching the program, but we would love it more if you send us some comments, critiques in particular. From Yikov Tahli and the entire team here at Economic Divide, it's goodbye until the next program.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about different verses of the Holy Quran related to humanity and pertaining to the concept of mankind in the teachings of the religion of Islam. So in the previous episodes, we talked about the position of intellect as one dimension of the soul of a human being. We talked about the position of intellect and the role that it has in understanding religion, in accepting the religion, and then following when a person accepts the religion or a person rejects religion, what happens to his reason. We talked about the concept of hujjah, the proof, and the false proofs or the false arguments that some people, they think they have produced with their intellect, and at the end of the day we may realize that it was not a result of their intellect, it was mainly or basically the result of their carnal desires. And talking about the concept of hujjah, there's also the concept or the need that we have to our intellect after a person accepts the religion. Some people, they say, okay, we search for religion, we found the right religion, and now it's full obedience and blind obedience. It could be correct, it could be incorrect. It could be correct in a sense that once a person has settled with the totality of an ideology, like the religion of Islam, then understanding other philosophies, minor reasonings within the fold of the religion could be easier. Like, for example, then a person can understand why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has ordered us, for example, to pray, because there is a humility there, there is a connection that we build with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and remembrance of Him throughout the day and other things. Or, for example, fasting, different aspects of it. But do we claim that we know the full answer to all these questions? No. So it's always somewhere at the middle. It's not blind obedience, and it's not fully a full-fledged understanding of all different aspects and all different philosophies there. And that is actually the use of intellect in order to have as much as possible ma'rifah of what we do. Has been advised in different teachings of Islam, especially the hadith that we have, that the ma'rifah is what matters, and the ibadat that we have, if they turn into habits, the acts of worship, if they turn into blind habits that we just do automatically, they are not going to benefit us. They're good, like in comparison to people who don't have even that habits or those habits, it's much better because they function as something that hold our life together. Our life are scattered moments of different actions and reactions that we have, and if we don't have something that hold this together, then when at the end of our life, when we look back and we see the life that we have left behind, we see that there is no unifying factor there. But these acts of religion, even at the level of habits, if we carry them out, they hold this lifetime together much better than those who didn't have them. But habits are not the goal or the objectives of acts of worship. In the hadith that we read, we realize that we have to develop a ma'rifah, knowledge, so that every act of worship that we carry out should be different from the previous one. It should help us in the progress that we make in the journey of spirituality. There's one beautiful hadith in this regard that we're gonna read, inshallah, after the break.
dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi, and you're listening to a program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. Now, we are supposed to read a hadith that tells us the position of intellect after a person accepts religion of Islam. From Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, one of the companions of the Imam says, I asked the Imam, or I told the Imam, Jul to Fadak, Inna li jaran kathir as-salat. May Allah bless you. I have a neighbor who is very good in acts of worship, a lot of prayers he perform, kathir al-sadaq, a lot of charity he gives, kathir al-hajj, he performs a lot of pilgrimage to Mecca. La ba'sa bih, no problem with that. Faqal ya Ishaq kayfa aghlu. Imam alayhi salam asked his companion, what about his intellect? What about the level of rationality, the level of understanding that he has? قال قلت له جئت فداك ليس له عقل. It's not that he understands that much. قال فقال لا يرتفع بذلك من. The Imam said, it does not go up. Those acts of worship does not help him in going up in the levels of spirituality. So the Imam didn't say it's completely useless, but it doesn't have the function it is supposed to have. It doesn't have the function that it was designated for those acts. What was the function? What was the goal of these acts of worship? For people to grow spiritually. In order for a person to grow spiritually, he has to know what is he doing. For example, if you're doing, for example, Salat, we should dedicate a time as Muslims to study about different levels of prayer. And that's why there had been, and there has been, and there is a tradition among great scholars that they write down Asrar al-Salah, the secrets of prayer. Secrets of prayer meaning philosophy of each and every act in the prayer and Salat that we have. Like, for example, when you say Allahu Akbar, what does it mean based on the hadith and the verses of the Holy Quran? And what should we think about when we do the Salat? And this stage, for example, Qira'ah, when we recite Surah Al-Hamd, there's a famous story from Shahid Mutahari. He says, I had a teacher in Nahj al-Balagha, and that teacher was very spiritual. And once he told me, do you have Hudur al-Qalb? Are your heart present in Salat, in prayer? That is one aspect or one teaching that we have in Islam, that as much as you can focus in your prayer is accepted at that level. If you focus 20%, 20% of your prayer is accepted. So that teacher asked me, do you focus in prayer? I said, yes. He said, how do you focus, or what do you focus on? And I said, I focus on the meaning of the sentences that I recite. For example, the phrases of the Quran, if they are there, I focus on the meaning. And then that teacher said, so when do you pray Salat? If you're focusing on the meaning, you see, there are different levels even for the presence of the heart in the prayer, and we have to know them. It's like, it's an unfortunate situation that some of the good practicing brothers and sisters, they have spent years of praying, but they don't know, they have not studied about this. So the Imam says, using your intellect in order to understand and gain ma'rifah of acts of worship is actually necessary for us to have that spiritual development and growth. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us have that spiritual growth by increasing our own ma'rifah. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.